And so today I thought we'd talk about taking ownership of your health and how we got in the mess we're in and what we can do about it. Because everybody wants to cut to the chase. You know, as you think about writing a book, or at least as I think about writing a book, you realize there's a million freaking books out there on health and on nutrition and on diets and on diseases and, you know, all sorts of ways that you can categorize things. You know, only eat green food on Thursday and, you know, only eat things with one eyeball. And, you know, I'm being silly, of course, but the idea being that it seems like every subject is covered. But what I see over and over again is individuals who have to deepen their commitment to health. And you certainly are one of those individuals because you listen to this show on a regular basis. You want more information so that you can make a better choice. You know, there's a real natural tendency for all of us to accept doctor's advice. The idea that you put yourself in the hands of a competent professional that you trust to make decisions about your health, it's a pretty common thing. I see it in my practice all the time. We still salute the doctors. Making appropriate choices about your health should be your decision, not somebody else's. It's not a good idea to defer to somebody else for advice, me included. You know, there's so many options available today. Some of you don't know where to turn. But physicians commonly, and it's true, it doesn't matter whether they're chiropractors or acupuncturists or MDs or DOs, there's a tendency for physicians to follow the particular approach that they use because they're proud of their skills. Surgeons cut. We call it healing with steel in the business. You know, urologists do procedures. Gastroenterologists do procedures. It's what they do. But you're a unique person, and you have unique preferences and goals. You know, two equivalent medical treatments may not be equally beneficial for you. In fact, some people might prefer a treatment that's less likely to cure them than something that is more aggressive and has side effects. Other people are willing to risk any side effect. I read a story about a lady who's a 5-year survivor of multiple metastases. And she was willing to sign up for every chemo that there was, and it's bought her time. Only you can make these kind of decisions. Your doctor can't. Only you should develop your own program. So take other people's advice and synthesize it, and you say, well, I want to find the expert. Well, all of us are experts in narrow fields. Remember, the definition of an expert is just somebody that knows 5% more than the rest of the people in the room. So we need to reconsider the meaning of health. You know, health is not just the absence of disease. I have people in my practice all the time that walk in the door and say, I was perfectly healthy until the day before I had my heart attack. I was perfectly healthy until the day before I had cancer. You know, I can have a 20-year-old come in my office that already has early stage atherosclerosis or even cancer. Doesn't prevent them from having an outward expression of really vigorous health. And that may continue for years or even decades before this disease process that's underway actually manifests and become apparent. The point is that happy, healthy, productive people achieve this state of healthiness despite the presence of a disease. You can be the same way. Even if you just got a diagnosis last week, doesn't mean you can't feel healthy and enjoy your life and be radiant. But you got to take ownership of your health. You've got to take ownership of the management of your health. You need to craft a program that emphasizes health and minimizes disability. Understanding how health can fail really is a part of this. Because once you have that information, you can make changes in your life that can help you accomplish avoidance of deterioration. You know, when you set up a regular program of exercise, you improve your balance and your strength and your endurance so you can enjoy life. I've said many times, old and weak are not two words you want in the same sentence. What you want is old and strong. You also have to attend to your emotional needs. You know, lots of studies on happiness show that family and friends and social networks make a big difference in keeping you feeling satisfied and healthy. I read a study last night that talked about the fact that individuals that have a social network, and they might have three different groups. So they might be playing bridge with one group, and they might be with another group because they're sorority sisters, and they might be a member of the Sarasota Democrats. In those kinds of situations, having those social networks really makes a difference. You know, the social network I was with on Saturday night, I had a really, really lovely Saturday night because the Veterans for Common Sense that my husband helped to found had their Thomas Paine birthday party, Thomas Paine's 276th birthday party. He's looking pretty good for 276, I got to tell you. And being with those veterans and their spouses and talking about the things that are near and dear to my heart, liberty is an example. And seeing my buddy Rob Lori receive the award for the Thomas Paine Pioneer, it's a feel-good thing. It's nice to be in a room where people know you and you know their names and you can have a conversation. It's something I can't put in a pill. So yeah, you have to adopt dietary recommendations that are going to help your health. You want to control your blood pressure and your blood sugar and reduce your risk of disease. But you also want to understand that keeping yourself moving and attending to your emotional needs are part of what it takes. You know, we've gotten into a mess. You know, if history has taught us anything, it's that people pay little attention to history. You know, medicine seems to all be about what's new. What's new? What's new? Oh, there's a new drug. Oh, there's a new surgical procedure. Oh, there's a new diet. Oh, there's a new piece of exercise equipment. Oh, there's a new test. Not only do we forget about what is old, but we cast it off. I was on the phone on Saturday with a client, and I was recommending a couple of low-level interventions to her. You know, during the time that I lived in Northern Arizona and worked with people on the reservation up there, the Hopis and the Navajos primarily, but the Wallapais and Supais and Havasupais and such, I was working with a cashless society. Gee, even when I was living in Flagstaff, I was working with a cashless society. You know, I commonly took trades for the consults I did, everything from a beaded necklace to a cord of wood. You know, my all-time favorite story from when I was living in Arizona is when I quit being a vegetarian and I actually accepted an elk liver as payment for a consult. Little did I know that the size of a 600-pound animal's liver looked like he had an infant in swaddling clothes when he brought that liver to my house. You know, the joke was we were having liver milkshakes by the end of that season. We forget about these low-level interventions like treat anemia by eating liver. Maybe we're too hasty to glom on to what's new, what's new, what's new. You know, we have a tendency to think that the new things have more advantages. You know, we can't imagine operating without modern conveniences that have been brought to us by technology over the last years. I mean, I had a teenager in my practice and I went to use a piece of carbon paper and they didn't know what it was. I made a reference to a phone booth. They didn't know what it was. I made a reference to a typewriter. They looked at me blankly. You know, even the ballpoint pen that I pick up wasn't in common usage the day I was born. So there's plenty of technologies that are available to those of us in industrialized nations. And there's plenty of technologies that continue to be available to us in medicine and healthcare. But remember, just because it's new doesn't necessarily mean it's better. I mean, if I was one of those people who had a hip replacement and then I saw that the company that made the device already knew that it was defective when they put it in my hip, I'd be pretty mad. But what we see is that in this day and time, this westernized lifestyle that we have created keeps moving around the globe and are transforming the dietary patterns of lots of people, both in industrialized nations and in developing countries. So these countries that are, well, they're mocking us in some way by copying us. You know, now you can find a French fry parlor on every corner in China. So when we look at the fact that we keep sending our obesity-related illnesses together with our obesity-related dietary patterns to other parts of the world, we begin to look at what I call SAD, the standard American diet. You know, I learned this in the West when looking at the Pima Indians. The Pima Indians of Mexico walk everywhere. The Pima Indians of Arizona drive their pickup trucks. The Pima Indians in Mexico are very active physically, tending their garden and walking up and down the hills. And the Pima Indians of Arizona spend an average of 5 hours every day in front of the television. And so the Pima Indians in Arizona end up diabetic by age 40. It's not uncommon for a woman to weigh 300 pounds by their 50th birthday, and it's pretty uncommon to find a 60-year-old Pima who lives in Arizona. Whereas the Pima Indians in Mexico are lean, mean fighting machines and live to old ages. Well, you know, every diet book you pick up, every new nutrition book that you pick up gives you something else to be afraid of. But I collect cookbooks, and I've got some cookbooks that are more than 100 years old. And when I read about the oatmeal with plenty of thick cream and maple sugar and the fried potatoes and the buckwheat pancakes and the sausages and gravy with butter and maple syrup and the preserves and jams and jellies and donuts, well, they ate that meal, and then they went out and worked. You know, the human diet has always been an imperfect compromise between what we could get our hands on and what we wanted. For millennia, we tried to just survive. We tried to just have enough food and water. You know, we ate foods in season before they spoiled because we didn't have refrigerators to put them into. It was a matter of life and death. When I talk to clients and about their cortisol levels, because I measure cortisol for saliva samples in one day when you get up at noon and 5 o'clock and 10 o'clock at night to see how your adrenal glands are performing, because people that are tired always walk into my clinic and they go, oh, I have adrenal exhaustion. And I go, no, I don't think so. You might have adrenal fatigue, because we can repair adrenal fatigue. Adrenal exhaustion, you can get them better, but you can't get them well. But the nature of it is the reason we have high cortisol first thing in the morning is we're designed to wake up and hunt. We were designed to wake up with the sun and go out and gather food. And so, you know, hunting implies that you're going out and getting a squirrel or a bird, but, you know, you were hunting for berries, you were hunting for nuts, you were hunting for whatever was out there. Now we just entertain ourselves all day long until we decide to drive through our favorite fast food establishment and speed away moments later with 2,500 calories of food sitting on the passenger seat while driving 70 miles an hour down a busy freeway texting. That whole drive-through takes less time than it took to gather some wood to make the fire. So 10,000 years ago, when we started domesticating plants and animals, we created lifetime agriculture. You know, prior to that, we were hunter-gatherers. It doesn't matter where in the world you go, we were hunter-gatherers. We didn't stay in one place where you'd put the seed in the ground and grow the plant and make sure the deer didn't eat it and then harvest the plant and then store the plant. When we grew what the native people call the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, you grew squash because it has great big leaves and it covered the ground to reduce evaporation, and you grew the beans that coiled up the stalk of the corn. So the three sisters were the earliest crops. And very soon after that, we domesticated animals. And then we started growing cereal grains. And pretty soon, dairy products and sugar and oil and fatty meats and salts followed right along. So that's where we came from. We came from real food. You know, meats and starches have always been the favored main dishes in America, along with some vegetables boiled over hours. People used to put it on the stove and cook it all day long. So the nature of the American diet has changed pretty markedly in the last 100 years. You know, from the refrigerator to the preservatives, from the freezer to the cans. You know, we don't have food scarcity now. We don't have a lack of selection. It's the other way around. We got too many things to pick from. And so we've created new staples, and the new staples are not the three sisters, corn and squash and beans. The three sisters now are refined flour, sugar, and vegetable oil. I mean, flour, oil, and sugar have always been a part of the American diet, but the proportion of these staples has changed, and the nutritional content of them has changed. You know, prior to the Industrial Revolution, when we had stone mills, flours had the entire contents of the grain. They had the germ and the bran and the endosperm, what you call the wheat germ. And then about 150 years ago or so, flour mills were introduced. And white flour, which was stripped of its germ that has all the good vitamin E in it, stripped of its bran that has the good fiber in it, became a staple in the American diet. It allows for longer storage of flour. It makes it easier to produce all sorts of bread and pastry. Actually, white flour was considered by some to be healthier because it was less likely to spoil. But all those B vitamins and iron and thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, folic acid that were removed when we took away the bran and the germ downturned the quality of this food. And then right on its heels came the increase of using sugars. The consumption of refined sugar per capita in the United States is between 130 and 150 pounds per person, according to whose literature you read. And the majority of it comes from sweetened carbonated beverages. Soda pop is the enemy. I still predict that in my lifetime, soda pop will be taxed like cigarettes, and it'll cost you $4 a can. And at that point, maybe people will stop drinking so much. The candies and the cakes and the cookies and the pies, you know, follow right along behind the soda pop, but there ain't nothing that beats soda, carbonated, sweetened carbonated beverages, and sweetened teas for that matter. You've heard me rail before about the, you know, green tea and the big can from my old Arizona homestead that's got just as much sugar in it as a can of carbonated beverage. We know there's a link between our crisis of metabolic diseases and sugar consumption. We know that the intake of the calories through these sugar-sweetened beverages has contributed dramatically to obesity, dramatically to diabetes, dramatically to heart disease. When we look at the production of soft drinks, you know, when I was in grade school, they were served in 7 and 8 ounce bottles. You know, in the last dozen years, now we have 64 ounce containers of soda pop. The production of soft drinks has increased tenfold, especially among adolescents. Today, Americans consume twice as many sweetened carbonated beverages as they did 25 years ago. They add almost 500 calories a day from these beverages. And they cost $54 billion a year. You're wondering where all the money's going. There's going. When people say, oh, I don't have the money for vitamins, I go, well, take out the soda pop out of your cart and you'll have plenty of money for organic food and nutrients. But the third sister that's hooked together with the white flour and the sugar is vegetable oil. You know, this major shift in the fats and oils in cooking has happened in my lifetime. You know, butter and lard were the preferred products till Crisco came out. And then we took these oily seeds like soybean or corn or sunflower or safflower, rapeseed, canola, and we created technology that allowed us to take these high-yield oil seeds and use heat and solvents in order to extract the oils. And so our per capita consumption of salad and cooking oil has jumped a couple 100% in the last 100 years. Margarine consumption has increased 500%. So people thought that the sat fats in butter and lard were bad news, but the polyunsaturated seed oils were a good trend, and in some ways they were correct, but it didn't produce the benefits that we thought they were going to. The first part is that we're just simply consuming more fat calories. More polyunsaturated fats are an addition to rather than a replacement for saturated fat calories. And this abundant availability of these cheap liquid oils makes deep frying, well, it's just everywhere. We can fry anything, especially if you live in Texas. Somehow Texas has a handle on it. When my husband and I made a trip to West Texas a couple of years ago to attend the West Texas Star Party, this is a group of amateur astronomers on a mountain looking at the sky for a week at a camp. We couldn't find anything to eat. I mean, we went into a restaurant and everything was fried. Even the dessert was fried. We create these partially hydrogenated oils. We create this new fatty acid structure called a trans fat, which we know contributes tremendously to insulin resistance, tremendously to a higher inflammatory burden, and tremendously to contributing to the process of disease. But not only have we switched over to these sisters of white flour and vegetable oils and sugar and away from corn and beans and squash, but the other thing that's disappeared is the family meal. You know, growing up, we sat down and ate dinner together, my mom and dad and I. But a lot of kids today, they don't sit down with their parents for a meal. A lot of them never eat a meal together. It's grab and go. And not only that, we have become an entire nation of snackers. Now the snack consumed between meals is de rigueur. A lot of people think they have to have a snack between breakfast and lunch, and another snack between lunch and dinner, and of course a snack between dinner and bedtime. There's a tremendous increase in calories in the American diet from snacks. I like them too. I had some yesterday, but I don't have them every day. And I sure don't have them between breakfast and lunch and between lunch and dinner. Every once in a while, I'm going to have a bowl of crunchies. I did last night. I had some cashews and a few little soy chips and vegetable chips. But all in all, we look at adolescents and we look at children and we see the contribution to obesity that's happening among youth and young adults especially. We've made a huge, big change in what we do. And as a result of that, it's created one of the biggest threats to our finances. You know, when I listen to the Yahoos talking about the debt crisis, you know, the nonsense in today's paper about, you know, voting for a balanced budget, what happens is they don't realize that the single biggest cost that is going to happen to America in the future are obese children. There isn't anything that's going to cost this country more money than the obesity in kids that we see today. Because these children are going to be entering the healthcare system by age 30 when we're used to having them enter the healthcare system at age 70. So we're going to have two effects from that. We're going to have huge health costs in taking care of these obese kids who are going to have more diabetes, more blindness, more amputation, more neuropathy, more heart disease, more problems across the board. But you know what? They're also the caregivers of those of us that are older. So those of us that are baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964, after 1964, we have a narrowing of the population. We have less people to take care of the people that are older. And now, if that group of people ends up in the healthcare system at the same time that the baby boomers end up in the healthcare system, we're all up the creek. Because we've doubled the demand on the healthcare system and we've reduced by half the caregivers available. So, you know, the smartest thing to do is to stay healthy. It's to work on what we already know. You know, when Einstein said, if we knew what it was that we were doing, it would not be called research, would it? But we do know some things. And we do know that you get nothing but benefits from eating higher amounts of fruits and vegetables. We do know that you get nothing but benefits when you eat fundamentally poultry and seafood and you reduce or eliminate the four-legged animals, what people often call the red meat. We know that we get a benefit when we reduce the amount of sugar-sweetened beverages in the diet. We know we get a benefit when we exercise more and we exercise regularly. You know, there's no such thing as unbiased research. Doesn't mean there isn't honest research and good research, but there's always bias in research. And, you know, over and over again, as I read studies, I keep realizing how much bias there is. And there's especially bias when reporters get a hold of a study. Because at the point that reporters get a hold of a scientific study, you've got no idea what they're actually going to report about what happened. You know, I can look at so many studies that the headline said something very dramatic, you know, vitamin E does not benefit you. But they never went underneath to read the whole study and find out what it really said, that in fact the vitamin E that they used was synthetic vitamin E. Came to us from petroleum. It didn't come to us from sesame seeds and sunflowers. So, yes, you can find a study to prove most anything. But I think until such time as you deepen your commitment to health, you're not going to try to make changes. Try to spend a little less time in front of the television. You know, 99% of American households have at least one television, and the majority of them have more than one. TV viewing exceeds the time spent in any other leisure activity and is the principal sedentary behavior in the United States. So for every hour of television that you watch, it shortens your lifespan more than smoking a cigarette. And if you're smoking a cigarette while you're watching television, don't buy any long-term insurance. But when we look at the statistics measuring the time that children spend watching television, 4 hours of television per day, it means that by the time that we get to high school graduation, kids have spent more time watching television than they have been in the classroom. When I was a kid, we were always outside. My mother was always standing on the porch screaming to come home for dinner. We were out playing. We were playing ball. We were playing in the palmettos. I grew up in rural Florida. I was in my playhouse. I was in the tree. There was no sitting in front of the TV. dozens of studies have confirmed the connection between watching TV and obesity rates in adults and children. The prevalence of obesity is four times greater among individuals who watch 20 or more hours of TV a week as compared to those who watch 7 hours or less. What I see in my practice are individuals that just are too stressed. I had a new client last week, and in the first hour she was in my office, she kept using the word stress over and over and over again. And I started making little tick marks on the side of my notes every time she used the word stress. And by the time that I had finished taking her history, I had over 30 marks on my paper. So when you use the word stress, stress means different things to different people. You know, stress could be your economic. Stress could be the traffic on 41. Stress could be your mother-in-law. Stress could be that your bra doesn't fit right. But there's a huge amount of demand on us today. And where it affects us is we lose sleep. We either can't get to sleep because our mind is racing, or we wake during the night because we're uncomfortable, or we wake up and we can't go back to sleep. We're losing sleep over the last couple of centuries. You know, the median sleep duration in 1960 was over 8 hours a night. Only 15% of people reported 7 hours a night. But by the time we got to this century, sleep duration had dropped to 7 hours. And 2.5 times as many people reported getting less than 7 hours. When we look at the nature of sleep, we think that we are saving time by not sleeping. We could sleep less and we would have more time, but it simply isn't so. You know, electric lights compelled us to change our sleep habits. We no longer went to bed when the sun went down and got up when the sun got bright in the sky. You know, the limited light that was produced by candles and lanterns extended our day, but it shortened the amount of time that we slept. And now, entertainment, whether it's in the form of television watching or whether it's keeping your monitor on your computer so that you can post one more thing to Facebook before you close your eyes, sleep gets delayed. It even gets prevented. Poor sleep patterns, especially short sleep duration, have to do with the obesity epidemic, have to do with an increased risk for diabetes and heart disease. You know, when we look at the fact that something like 75 million Americans suffer from some sort of insomnia, you know, I get the heebie-jeebies every time somebody comes in and they say they're taking a product that's got PM at the end of the name, that they're putting diphenhydramine into their brain every single solitary night in order to get to sleep. I keep trying to tell people, you may be unconscious, but you're not sleeping. You know, individuals taking sleeping pills are 3 times more likely to die early than people who have never taken those medications. That means in some way, early death is connected to sleep disorders, sleeping pills, or whatever the root cause of the sleep disturbance was. Maybe all of them contribute a portion to the risk. But the nature of stress is often self-imposed. It's self-imposed by us making things more important than they should be. So whether it's our diet or our physical inactivity or our inflammatory burden or our poor sleep habits or our changes in our family dynamics or our changing work schedules or our growing amount of electronic gadgetry that's keeping us awake, it's all contributing to our stress. We've had a huge change to our physiology. We've had a huge change in terms of our lifestyle, and we've had a huge change in terms of our diet. And so if we want to maintain a wholesome, diverse diet with normal physical activity, And we want to get out in the sunlight, and we want to work and play, and we want to have a network of friends. We want to really do prevention. Well, we already know how to leverage very many things in order to get us healthier. You know, when we start out with simple things like saying, oh, an apple a day. You know, that old adage, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But epidemiology backs up that notion. People who frequently eat apples are at a reduced risk for lung and colon cancer, for asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, for cardiovascular disease, for Alzheimer's disease, for type 2 diabetes. Just something simple like that. You know, the average apple, 6 or 7 ounce apple, it's got water in it. It's got good carbs in it. It's got fiber in it. It's got very little protein, but it's got low to modest levels of a whole bunch of vitamins and a few minerals. And it's got phytonutrients and carotenoids and flavonoids. One medium apple eaten with the skin has a capacity to deliver a few dozen signals, which have been shown to improve our health. If you make it into applesauce, you might diminish the fiber concentration. If you make it into apple juice, you've taken out the fiber. We can turn it into something that's a high glycemic index drink, very different from the whole fruit. Remove the skin and you lose a lot of those important vitamins and phytonutrients. But if you purchase commercial apples and you don't wash the skin, you might be getting agricultural pesticides. Who knew an apple could be this complicated? You know, these flavonoids that make up a large portion of the phytonutrients in the apples and the flavonoids present in apples like quercetin. Quercetin has lots of health-promoting functions. We talked about quercetin to use during hay fever season. We know that there's a tremendous benefit just from this simple flavonoid. So when we do something as simple as adding apples into our diet, we're making a deeper commitment to health. I think there's a place for us to know that the body is a symphony. I think there's a place where we need to give up the idea that the South Beach diet or the Atkins diet or the Paleo diet or list 20 other ones are going to be the very best thing for us to follow. Probably of all of the ones that I've ever read, the Mediterranean diet is the one that comes closest to what I endorse. When we look over and over again at what you should eat, it really gets down to a simple list. Eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. And when I say plenty, I mean plenty. I mean at every meal. There's not a meal that you take that you don't have fruits or vegetables in it. When we look at the nature of volume, you know, it's often recommended that 5 a day keeps the doctor away, 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. But in fact, what's true is we really eat 9 or 12. We need to consume a lot of fiber. And consuming a lot of fiber doesn't just mean that we take bran tablets or slug back a glass of Metamucil mud. Consuming a lot of fiber says that we eat whole foods. We eat the apple with the skin instead of drinking a glass of apple juice. Eliminating red meat is a really good idea. And I use the term red meat even though I like the First Nation way of referring to it as four-legged animals. And it's not because they're bad. It's because too much of them is bad. And it's also because the planet can't continue to support the amount of meat that we are demanding. So if you cut those servings down to 2 a week, out of 14 lunches and dinners, out of 21 breakfast lunches and dinners, you only have 4-legged animals twice a week, you're going to do yourself a big favor. You know, when we look at the chicken and turkey and duck and when I was in Egypt, pigeon. And I said to the waiter, pigeon, and then realized it was pigeon. When we eat those animals with feathers and we eat the animals with fins, wild-caught fish and shellfish and crustaceans, we do ourselves a way bigger favor than eating a lot of red meat. When we combine rice and grains with legumes and other fresh vegetables, when we look at some of the most long-lived people in the world who have a rice and bean-based diet, whether you're in Southeast Asia and it's rice and tofu or rice and tempeh, or you're in India and it's wheat and dal, or you're in the Middle East and it's pita bread and hummus, or you go to Mexico and Central America and it's corn tortillas and refried beans. In New Orleans, it's red beans and rice. In Atlanta, it's black-eyed peas and cornbread. And in Boston, it's Boston brown bread with baked beans. We're ensuring proper nutrition. It takes 700 decisions to make it through a food day. And I know that sounds silly when you say it at first. But you know, whether I had organic tea or non-organic tea, and whether I put the coconut creamer in it or the soy creamer in it or half and half in it, and whether I put, you know, Splenda in it or stevia in it or sugar in it or honey in it, you know, there's a half a dozen decisions just around making a cup of tea. And I had papaya from my tree this morning and wild blueberries out of the freezer and some pineapple that I don't care if it's organic because they don't have pesticide residues on them. And mixed them together and had them with my organic yogurt. Do you see that it takes a dozen or 20 decisions just to get through breakfast? And then the meal gets even more complicated as we, or the decisions get more complicated as we go through the day. You know, there was certainly a place where I advocated a vegetarian diet. I was a vegetarian exclusively for 12 years, as I've told you before. But then I realized the body didn't do well. Not everybody did well on that diet. You know, there was a beautiful study that was done in Cape Town, South Africa, about 15 years ago. And they studied trained cyclists because trained cyclists really have great metabolism. And they measured the percent of energy derived from burning fat versus the amount that was burning carbohydrate. And at rest, the proportion using fat ranged from a low of 25% to a high of 100%. And then when the cyclist exercised at 70% of their maximum heart rate, fat contributed anywhere from 0 to 40%. So what I'm telling you is some people are readily able to switch to fat burning for all of their energy at rest, and up to 40% of their energy when they're in doing intense exercise. But there's others that have great difficulty switching to fat burning, even when they're at rest. And so you can see how people who burn fat well can lead a normal life and feel fine on a high-protein, high-fat diet, while those who need carbohydrates just feel terrible. So one of the areas that we differ is some of us are fat burners and others of us are carb burners. And most of us are a mixture of those two extremes. But it tells us why some people tolerate high carb diets and some people end up gaining abdominal fat on high carb diets and increase their triglyceride levels and reduce their good HDL cholesterol. That's why diets have to be tailored to the individual. Or at least as far as the fat and carbohydrate goes, the protein needs don't really change all that much. So I'm spending time just giving an overview. You know, that's one of the nice things about designing your own show. You get to talk about what you want to talk about. And I felt like we needed to go back and focus on that overview. Why do you do what you do? Are you trying to achieve a goal? You know, being a size 12 by the dance? Are you trying to just feel better? Trying to look better? Trying to treat disease? All of us have slightly different motives. But for virtually all of us, There are very, very similar things that we can do that can improve our health. And I hope that listening to No Nonsense Nutrition is one of the ways that you improve your health. And remember, if you ever want to listen to yesterday, you can always go up on eveplews/podcast and get some of the dozens and dozens of shows that are listed there.